What the Zoning Atlas can tell us is whether communities are too restrictive in the ways that they permit, or in many cases do not permit, housing. And by being able to portray that graphically, it's a pretty easy tool for advocates to use to help to justify their push for reform.
Helping community leaders grow financially resilient, resource conscious, and people friendly cities is the Go Cultivate podcast, brought to you by Verdunity.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of our Go Cultivate podcast. I'm Kevin Shepherd, and I've got AJ Favre with me here again today. Good morning, or good afternoon, AJ.
Let's not do morning again. It's definitely afternoon.
we're in the middle of a number of projects and trying to wrap some things up, and have, you know, been cranking on our normal day jobs and just taking a quick break to get this one finished up and out. This episode is one I was really looking forward to having this conversation with Sarah Bronin. And AJ, why don't you just give a quick overview of who our guest is today, who you spoke with, and kind of what the subject of the interview was.
Yeah, so Sarah is known for many things. She's definitely got some extensive expertise in land use law, historic preservation. She is the co-founder of Desegregate Connecticut, which we talk a lot about in the interview. And then, of course, most recently, she's known for her role in getting the Zoning Atlas up and running, which I don't really want to spoil that too much. So I will leave it at that, because we do get into what the Zoning Atlas entails and what it's intended to do. But if, you know, you're a listener and you're someone that's really interested in this whole notion of demystifying zoning and trying to create regulations that are easy to understand and that are accessible and that are focused on getting the right outcomes, I think then this is definitely an episode that you'll hopefully be interested in and intrigued by.
We spend a lot of time talking about zoning with at different levels with communities, and when the Zoning Atlas that you got rolled out, I saw the first kind of materials coming out about it and really thought, you know, what a great idea, what a great resource. And there are, you know, there are some similarities, I think, with some of what she and her group has done there with some of the mapping that we do fiscally, and how do you use that mapping information to help with advocacy and education, and ultimately inform policies. So let's jump right in. This is AJ's interview with Sarah Bronin about the National Zoning Atlas.
Well, I couldn't be more excited about today's episode. Joining me is Sarah Bronin, whose list of accomplishments is beyond impressive. She is a Mexican-American architect, attorney, and policymaker, a professor of planning and law at Cornell University, and the founder of Desegregate Connecticut and the National Zoning Atlas. Now, if you follow planning topics like historic preservation, land use, or climate change, you've undoubtedly listened to, read about, or watched her in action at some point. In our show notes for this episode, we will link you to many of her pieces. Sarah, thanks for being here today. I really appreciate you making the time for our interview.
Thanks so much for having me, AJ.
I've been following the National Zoning Atlas, and I knew our listeners would want to hear from you as soon as I saw it in the news. One of the biggest challenges that we hear in our circles is this notion of really breaking down the way that we communicate to the public about what we're trying to achieve with zoning and land use, and how zoning ordinances around the country typically are not achieving what it is that our intentions truly are. Zoning reform is a topic that's been very hot over the last few years, as we're seeing some of the larger cities in the country step out and take a different approach to doing things. As those zoning reform efforts start to gain traction around the country, what's becoming clear about the way that zoning has been established and the way that it's been regulated for over a century in the United States?
Well, zoning is the local regulation of land use, and over the last 100 years, it has evolved to become a tool that really keeps communities the same over an extended period of time. Many zoning codes were adopted in the early to mid 20th century, the ideas that are contained in those zoning codes are still there today because they don't often get revised. And so right now we have a concerted effort across the country to really look at these traditional codes and try to figure out if the way that they were written decades and decades ago is really the way that we want to live today.
Agreed. Well, let's talk about the Zoning Atlas itself. According to the website, which again, we'll link to in the show notes, the project is intended to, quote, translate and standardize zoning codes across the U.S. into a single accessible online resource. In fact, you've been quoted as saying it is the Rosetta Stone of zoning, so to speak. What path led you to this idea?
Well, I've been involved here in Connecticut with zoning reform efforts on the local and the statewide levels. And one of the questions that we as advocates always get asked is, well, how do you know zoning is so bad? What do our zoning codes even say? And we realized that by the time we looked at each and every zoning code across the state and tried to explain how one related to the other and one was different from the other and talk about the particulars of individual zoning codes, we realized that it would be a lot easier to collect information that would enable us to tell a more coherent story about the way that our state zones. So from there, we created the Connecticut Zoning Atlas, looking over 180 zoning codes, 32,000 pages of zoning text, and finding that across the state, we had over 2,600 different zoning districts, each with their own particular rules. And what we did was we said, well, what common ground can we find between these and how can we visually display them? So that process led to a map that anybody can access that shows the way that each district regulates housing, how much single family or multifamily housing is allowed in any particular town, what minimum lot sizes are required, and a number of other particular zoning characteristics that we saw over and over again across all of these jurisdictions. And we realized that people might not know about it. And so our graphic display or attempt to display it in a simple way hopefully helped to illuminate how people's individual towns zoned and then collectively how the state as a whole was doing on its zoning. And so that's really where the National Atlas Project came from, started in Connecticut, and now we have 10 states going.
So I'm glad you brought that up. So those 10 states, if I'm correct, are California, Connecticut, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Montana, New Hampshire, New York, Ohio, and Rhode Island that have all embarked on this effort. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. And you have small states, big states, Western states, East Coast states. And so I think that's a really great mix for us to kick off the Atlas project with, because it'll show across many different kinds of states how zoning codes work. And I think my guess is that these states will turn out to be pretty similar to each other, just given the way that zoning codes seem to have evolved nationally over the last 100 years.
Sure. And Connecticut was the first to complete the Zoning Atlas for their state. And you followed that up with a paper titled Zoning by 1,000 Cuts, which I really enjoyed reading through. It shares a lot of takeaways from the Connecticut initiative and also just gives some very basic framing of this issue that I think is really helpful for anyone that's interested in exploring this further. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the biggest lessons learned there in Connecticut?
Well, Connecticut, as your listeners know, is a fairly small state. And despite the fact that we have 180 different zoning jurisdictions, we were really surprised to see that there was a lot of common ground between all of these jurisdictions when you really investigated what the zoning codes say. For example, we found that 91% of land in Connecticut is zoned to allow for single-family housing. So that means that virtually every community across the state has a high percentage of land devoted to single-family housing. By contrast, we found that only 2% of land in the state allows for multifamily housing to be built as of right. And what that means is without an onerous public hearing requirement or other onerous processes that actually prevent that kind of housing from being built. So 91% versus 2%, those two figures paint a pretty stark picture. But there's a lot of other particular aspects of zoning codes that we studied that are described in that paper. Thanks for reading it. But one of the other things that we studied, for example, was minimum lot sizes. So a minimum lot size is a requirement that each house be built on a certain acreage of land. We were shocked to find in Connecticut that 80% of the state's residential land was subject to a 1 acre minimum. That kind of requirement really drives up housing prices. It pushes development outward into farmland and into forests, and it makes a community unwalkable, because if you are living on an acre of land and your next door neighbor is living on an acre of land, you guys are not walking to the nearest corner store. You are driving everywhere. And that kind of living is increasingly seen by health experts and environmental experts as detrimental to our happiness, our well-being, and the environment. So those are just a couple of things that that we uncovered, and a lot of other particulars, including things like minimum parking requirements, maximum height caps, and floor to area ratios are covered in the paper.
This idea of focused integrated mapping to demonstrate patterns and to be able to draw conclusions across the country, what are some other subject areas that you believe this same type of approach could reap benefits?
Well, understanding the way a community zones can tell us a lot about the way that community treats the environment. It can help us understand whether we are maximizing investments in transportation infrastructure. For example, if we're putting train stations in places that are zoned for large lot single family zoning, that is probably a bad public investment. And yet, by the way, that's what Connecticut has done, we found out with the Zoning Atlas. It can also help us understand how people access education and jobs, and can show us how we've locked in inequality in some communities simply by zoning people who can't afford to live in those communities out by making housing so expensive through zoning rules.
So using this great amount of data and knowledge, how has the work to date led to some legislative changes? And how do these collective efforts help with more effective advocacy, which is often an issue?
So using the Connecticut Zoning Atlas as our key example, because it is the first state to be totally completed, it has played a pivotal role in advocacy efforts. In the last legislative session in 2021, we used the Zoning Atlas to show that accessory dwelling units were not very freely permitted in the state, which led to a statewide law that legalized accessory dwelling units. Although it did allow towns to opt out, which we were not too happy about, but it leveled the playing field for those towns that have not opted out. We also used the Zoning Atlas to show how minimum parking requirements were adding to the cost of housing, particularly in wealthy communities that imposed extremely high minimum parking requirements on multifamily housing. One town, Darien, Connecticut, requires 3 parking spaces for a single studio apartment, which only makes sense if you never want that studio apartment to be built in the first place. So we also passed statewide parking legislation related to zoning. At the local level, too, the Connecticut Zoning Atlas has been used by local advocates to update zoning rules. For example, West Haven reduced its minimum lot size. Other communities have, before the statewide law goes into effect, legalized accessory dwelling units. Still other communities have reduced minimum parking mandates. So we know that the zoning atlas has been useful at both the statewide and local levels. And we think we're going to see a lot of that in other states too. In Montana, the Frontier Institute, which is leading the Montana Zoning Atlas, published a preliminary report with six cities in Montana showing how all of those cities zone. And they've started conversations with the legislature there about the importance of zoning reform, couched, I think, primarily in property rights grounds, but also housing affordability as Montana becomes increasingly popular for people to move to. So what the Zoning Atlas can tell us is whether communities are too restrictive in the ways that they permit, or in many cases do not permit, housing. And by being able to portray that graphically, it's a pretty easy tool for advocates to use to help to justify their push for reform.
That's wonderful. And I'm sure that that will pay dividends at every level. At Verdunity, one of the things that we do is help cities understand through a combination of planning and fiscal analysis that they can create local prosperity with the resources they have now. And one key to that is better utilizing the existing infrastructure instead of building outward, which Texas cities in particular tend to overlook and not think about. How has your work and the work of Desegregate Connecticut really worked to educate, challenge, and change mindsets about zoning and its connection to other areas that cities and states are really struggling to address retroactively?
And is your question really about trying to make existing cities more dense or trying to legalize infill housing in neighborhoods?
I think it's actually a little of both. I was reading in your paper, there was a mention of the need to better leverage existing infrastructure as it related to infill specifically. And so that, I think, is really my main focus in the question.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm a native of Houston, the largest city in the country without zoning, and a city that is well known for its sprawl. We do see we have seen an interest in Texas from some professors and some students in developing a zoning atlas so we can really get down into the weeds in those cities. So Houston, putting Houston aside, there have been some really interesting rezoning efforts that have been successful in some places, unsuccessful in others, in Texas cities and of course cities like it around the country. Thinking particularly of Austin and the big push for a rezoning there that unfortunately failed. And I think part of the rezoning that was proposed was trying to accomplish was to achieve that infill and to enable Austin to become more walkable, more friendly to a better scale of development, given the crush in population that the city has experienced just because it has so many desirable attributes. It's unfortunate that that effort failed. Hopefully the conversations will continue. And I think a zoning atlas project in a state like Texas could be a real conversation starter, and it could help to illuminate why in some cities, including Austin, but others too, you're seeing housing pressures and you're not seeing the kind of development that many people, including millennials, including seniors, say that they want to live in.
Well, you mentioned in your testimony to the Connecticut legislature that there are three primary arguments for zoning reform. Can you share those with our listeners and expand on them a bit?
Sure. So the three justifications that I talked about then and that we've carried through in the Desegregate Connecticut public-facing platform are the economy, the environment, and equity. And I'll start with the last one because that's really what motivated me to found Desegregate Connecticut and what has motivated so many organizations and people to get involved in the effort. So that effort is really about trying to change structures in our laws and policies that prevent people from mixing. And that might be racially, ethnically, economically, We see a lot of stratification here in Connecticut. In fact, a shocking degree for somebody from Texas, where I think our cities tend to be a lot more more mixed income. It's not so here in Connecticut. So equity for me is an important reason to pursue the structural changes that we've been talking about in Desegregate Connecticut, and that I think the data shows that we must do in order to have a fairer society. And that kind of the other two are wrapped in with that too. So if you don't allow for everybody to have access to education and to jobs and to opportunities, because you've locked them out of those opportunities by zoning them out of the communities with the opportunities, you're doing the economy a disservice too, because you're not enabling people to achieve their full flourishing. You're also hurting people and preventing them from being able to pursue homeownership or have economic mobility. So we found here in Connecticut that in our cities, interestingly enough, that was where we saw the most resistance in the zoning codes to accessory dwelling units. And it's our cities, which are majority Black and Latino for the most part. Hartford, where I live, is 85% Black and Latino and people of color, only 15% white. And before we changed the zoning code at the local level, Hartford had banned accessory dwellings too. We saw that in other cities. Meanwhile, the suburbs allowed that through zoning. And what that means is that suburban homeowners, much wider in population and higher income than people who live in cities, again, just generally, demographically, we see that from census data, they were able to capitalize on the fact that they owned a home and they were able to stay in their homes because they could, in many towns, rent out that accessory dwelling unit. So again, we have not fully mined or fully understood the economic impacts of zoning, but they're definitely there. And then the environmental impacts, you know, I talked about this a little bit when I talked about minimum lot sizes, but when you prevent people from building multifamily housing and you only allow for large lot single family housing, what you are doing is you are destroying the environment. You're setting up a system where we are going to take farmland. There's going to be pressure on our farmers, people who grow our food, to sell to suburban developers for large tract housing. You are going to eat into our forests. Connecticut, over a 25-year period, lost, I think, 15% of its forest and lots of farmland, too. So we need to pay attention to the impact of zoning. And so some people say, well, if I have a 1-acre lot, that means I'm spaced out from everybody. That's good for the environment. Well, the opposite is true. We found by tying the zoning atlas data to transportation-related emissions data that people who lived in communities with large lot zoning had 36% more transportation-related emissions than everybody else. So when you build communities that are sprawling, then you have this host of environmental consequences, the burdens of which are borne by mainly people in the cities who tend to not have cars. And in Hartford, we have a quarter to a third of our households in any given year don't own a car. They walk, bike, take public transit, use car alternatives. And that's where we need to go if we're going to survive as a species. So, I mean, is changing zoning going to solve all of our environmental problems? Probably not, but they play a really big role and an understudied role. And that's why it, to me, counts as, I guess, the top three reasons to change zoning.
Absolutely. Very, very good information. So I want to take a minute to ask you about a story that ran last year in the Connecticut Mirror, and it was based on the zoning atlas findings there in Connecticut. And the story highlights the contradiction between many zoning regulations there within the state and a Connecticut Supreme Court ruling on minimum square foot requirements. Now, in many states, there are legal decisions that relate to exclusionary zoning, and so this is a topic of interest nationwide. Can you talk for a moment about the contradiction that's present there in Connecticut and how you have or have not seen communities and towns addressing this?
Well, that particular story was about an interesting, it was about a case, a Connecticut Supreme Court case, that essentially said that towns could not require a minimum size for housing units beyond what was required by health and safety or by the building code. When we started collecting information for the Connecticut Zoning Atlas, we actually started without collecting information about minimum lot size. But the folks on our team noticed that that there were figures that came up again and again saying, if you build an apartment, you have to have 1,000 square feet. In one case, 2,000 square feet for each individual apartment. And so even though the Connecticut Supreme Court had said this was not something that towns could do, there in the letter of the law, you saw requirements for minimum square footages. I think that this probably happens all over the country all the time, where you have these zombie rules on the books at the local level. Even if the state has said they're not legal, local governments keep them on the books. And in fact, they probably enforce them against developers who are trying to build housing in their town and don't know better and don't know about that Supreme Court case. So we found hundreds of zoning districts that required these minimum housing sizes. And so, you know, just to broaden it out a bit to say that, again, you know, this is probably something that happens all around the country. So one of the reasons why we chronicled it here was to show how widespread it was, and to hope that by bringing that awareness, towns would either start to eliminate these requirements from strike them from their existing local laws, or that developers and homeowners could know that these particular provisions were not supposed to be enforced. Reinforcing the Connecticut Supreme Court ruling, the legislation that was passed in 2021 also prohibited towns from requiring a minimum unit size. So hopefully between those two provisions, we'll see some of those provisions roll off the books at the local level.
Yes, let's hope so. Well, you talked a little bit earlier about minimum parking, so I want to come back to that for a minute. And for our listeners, of course, this is the mandate that a certain number of parking spaces be provided for each developed site. So that's another area that there's some great information on the Desegregate Connecticut site. What would you say to people that protest the elimination of minimum parking requirements?
Well, I could point to the large number of cities that have jettisoned their minimum parking mandates, and the many case studies that have shown how new developments have happened by using either existing parking or by not paving over an entire lot for parking and using a combination of street parking and public transportation. Zoning codes that require developers to build parking assume that the people who wrote the zoning codes know better about market conditions and car use than the people who are highly motivated to maximize their investment and you know, make sure that if they're building housing, people will live there. They will build enough parking for those people, but not overbuild because they have a good sense of the market. Zoning code administrators and drafters might not, especially since many of these minimum parking rules were written decades ago based on some pretty outdated assumptions that were embedded in some Institute for Transportation Engineering engineers' advice. So I would say, you know, look to the city of Hartford. When I was chair of the Planning and Zoning Commission, we completely eliminated minimum parking requirements citywide. Buffalo, there's a number of cities that are listed on the Parking Reform Network webpage. So I would encourage folks to go there so you can see some neighboring towns that have eliminated minimum parking requirements. Many communities have eliminated them in their downtowns because those are the places where minimum parking mandates have proven to be extremely detrimental. Instead of having cute historic buildings, we've knocked them down to satisfy zoning requirements for parking. Instead of having any building at all, we walk by large surface parking lots as we try to get from one downtown destination to another. People are seeing that by lifting those parking mandates, downtown folks will share parking. They will share it at different times of day. And they will convert that surface parking to tax-paying vibrant uses that help to contribute to street vitality in a way that a depressing surface parking lot does not. So I'm a big fan of removing these requirements. I think people will account for parking if they need it. But it also helps to reverse a trend, which researchers have shown. The trend is that if you require developers to build parking, more people will drive. And so again, in light of our climate emergency, do we really want to have, as a structural matter, something that promotes, encourages, and even requires car use? I think we don't.
Excellent point. In your paper, Zoning by 1,000 Cuts, which we mentioned earlier, you caution that, quote, simply lifting bans on multifamily housing may not actually create more housing options. Can you expand a bit on that statement and share where you think there are opportunities to do exactly that, which is to create more housing options?
So a lot of reform efforts have focused on, you know, quote unquote, eliminating single family zoning by enabling 2, 3, 4 or more units to be built where single family housing might have only been permitted before. But the simplicity of that call obscures the fact that there are a number of other important zoning rules that constrain development in some ways almost as much as the number of unit caps that we see in zoning codes across the country. So we've talked about minimum lot sizes and minimum parking requirements, which when imposed for multifamily housing tend to make it a lot harder to build. So if you have an acre of land and you're building, let's say you have a half acre of land, you're building 10 apartment units, and the parking mandate is 2 spaces per unit, then you have to find a place to put 20 parking spaces on this lot in addition to building your 10 units. So you might have to build a 5-story building instead of a 2-story building. You might have to overpave the lot. You may have to reduce the number of apartment units that you plan to build. So that parking mandate is one of those 1,000 cuts that I try to point out reduces the possibility for housing to be produced. Similarly, height caps are very prevalent. We found in Connecticut that 85% or so of districts that allow residential land have height caps, and they have them to the tune of 3.4 stories at most. And so again, if you're planning to build a 20 unit apartment building, you're going to have to figure out a pretty big plot of land to do that if your cap on height is 3 stories. Just one last example, the example of the floor to area ratio, the multiple of the lot size that you're allowed to build in terms of square footage. So if your floor to area ratio is 2 on a half acre lot, you can build a building that is 43,000 square feet. If it is 0.5, you can build a building that is about 10,000 square feet. And so that floor to area ratio, even though it's not common in purely residential areas, it's another factor that constrains the amount of building that can be built on a site. And one that zoning reformers in New York State have actually started to look to as one of these 1,000 cuts on housing. So there are others for sure. And the paper covers a bunch of those, but those hopefully are some examples of the way that these hidden rules do just as much, if not more, to constrain housing than the single family, multifamily distinction.
You know, Sarah, there's a lot of discussion right now about what cities look like without zoning. There have been a number of books that have come out recently. There's been this discussion at the state and national levels of some of the bigger planning related organizations. Everyone's trying to answer this question of what cities look like without zoning. And there's fears about that from people that live in different communities that often see zoning as a way to prevent bad things from happening or affecting them. What would you offer to those people that are skeptical about the potential of cities without zoning rules?
I would consider myself something of a zoning optimist. I think that zoning has tremendous power to actually help us solve a lot of the problems that we see in our world. I think it can help us manage environmental change. I think it can help us address the housing crisis. I think it can actually create more equitable communities. And I think that it can help us keep a sense of charm, keep and foster a sense of charm in our neighborhoods. So I am not in the camp of people that thinks we should entirely eliminate zoning. In fact, being from Houston shows me the perils of living in a place with no zoning whatsoever. Houston has affordable housing stock in many respects, but it also has done a terrible job with managing the impacts of sprawl on the environment. So it's not necessarily zoning as a blanket rule is terrible. I think we need to harness zoning for good.
Great way to put it. It's really more of a recalibration, not throwing out the tool altogether.
Yeah.
Well, I'm interested to just ask you for a moment. I know you've also done a very large amount of work in historic preservation, an area which has also come under scrutiny as of recently, as we all try to find this better intersection between equity and preservation in our communities. And I wonder if you have any thoughts that you would share based on your vantage point on those issues.
So historic preservation has been a tool to help communities moderate the pace of change, but it has also been a tool that has proven to be a friend to affordable housing and to keeping people in their homes. And so I think a lot of the rhetoric about historic preservation right now overlooks the role that preservation has played in neighborhoods across the country over decades. In achieving these different social values. So I would say, you know, part of what preservationists need to do is to promote both the movement and the institutions of preservation as being in favor of sustainability and equity and affordability. Because if you look at the history of the preservation movement, you do see strands of all of those things across the decades. I mean, sustainability, you know, the greenest building is the one that's already built. People say we should be repurposing our existing buildings for modern use. And preservationists should continue to be flexible in applying standards that in some cases may be inflexibly applied by preservationists, by people in my own preservation community who might be thinking very rigidly about aesthetics and not thinking about, I think, what are the true values of preservation, which are sustainability and equity and affordability, as I said. So I think that's a tension right now because preservation is an easy target. You do have commissions that from time to time make decisions that I would consider to be outlandish, denying a solar panel in the back of a house or, you know, not allowing for a property subject to sea level rise to be raised and so on. So those are the kinds of things that in certain circumstances can be easily villainized by critics of preservation. But like zoning, historic preservation law can be a really valuable tool to improve our lives. And I hope to be able to continue to advocate on that side of things and to argue for the importance of preservation for so many different reasons.
It sounds like really there's a common thread running through a lot of the work that you've done and the various areas that you've focused. And it sounds like that common thread, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on it and your reflections on it perhaps, is kind of reassessing and reconnecting the values behind what we're trying to achieve with the mechanisms that we're trying to use to get there. Would you say that's accurate?
Yes, I love that. That's exactly what I'm trying to do. I appreciate that summary. Yeah.
Well, as soon as you get that completely figured out, we'll be watching and listening so that we can take those lessons and apply them elsewhere. I've so enjoyed this conversation with you, Sarah. It always comes too soon, but it's time to wrap up our episode. Listeners, if you want to continue taking a deep dive into these issues, there's so much to unpack, and there's so many ways that you can bring awareness to them in your own community. So be sure to review the show notes. Sarah, we're so grateful you've dedicated your time to giving us some really valuable insights and perspectives. I think a lot of your answers had elements that are very memorable and quotable. And the most productive conversations that we can have in our communities stem from someone having the courage to ask why, to ask how might we do this better, to ask who this affects. And so it sounds like your career has been built on asking a lot of those important questions that can help us all learn. So thank you so much for visiting with me and being featured on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, there you have it. I thought that was a good interview. Like I've said before, I always enjoy, you know, when you do your interviews, AJ, and I get to be the listener and listen to some of the conversations. And, you know, I thought, it was really interesting back and forth between you guys from your different perspectives about demystifying zoning. And I love that she called herself a zoning optimist. You know, mm-hmm. we talk so much about, oh, you know, should we eliminate zoning or, you know, all of the reasons why it's bad. And I really love that towards right. the end of the interview, she came back and talked about why it's good, you know, and, mm-hmm. you know, and ways to make it better. You know, you especially being a trained planner, having worked with a number of different cities and, you know, having to administer zoning or write codes or amend codes. Is there anything from the conversation or the research that you did leading up to the interview that really kind of jumped out as you as a big takeaway for you personally and for our work?
Well, I think one thing is the, you know, discussion that we had kind of in the middle of the interview about exclusionary zoning and
yeah.
the ruling there in Connecticut and how there were many city codes that were very obviously in violation of that. And I think Sarah did a good job of kind of explaining how that continues to happen. I do think that's low hanging fruit. I see a lot of this in Texas as well, where it's not necessarily bad intentions. But we have to be honest with ourselves that those regulations were often written with exclusion in mind. And so just being able to go through our codes and regulations and asking ourselves if by separate feature or in a totality, is it something that has the impact of being exclusionary? That's really critically important. And planners can be better advocates, I think, across the board of spotting these things and bringing them to attention rather than waiting until a problem occurs. I think another thing that's really helpful from the interview and that I think can be a resource for people that are listening and want to do more where they are is the way that Desegregate Connecticut has done a really good job of having a clear narrative in the work that they do and very clearly tying how zoning regulations, which seem, again, you know, very mundane and buried in minutia for most people, really connect to things that affect us in our daily lives. We make those assertions a lot. Not everyone is great about making that connection clear for the average person. I think that the different media things that they've created, the snippets of video and the fact sheets, mm-hmm. And the way that they've been able to use that in advocacy has been really important. I know we spend a lot of time in the communities where we work talking with people that have a desire to be an activist within their own community, but don't necessarily know how to get going and where to start. And so that kind of organization at a grassroots level, I think can serve as inspiration for a lot of people in their own communities. And then lastly, I think it's important to understand that something Sarah highlighted, which is that there really isn't a great amount of data out there when it comes to planners being able to look at zoning and the effects that it has on a wider scale. We're often left in the unfortunate position of having to look at that at a local level without much context for what's happening around us, or even regionally, there tends to be a lot of similarities. So getting that outside perspective of what is happening elsewhere is critical. And as you alluded to in the beginning, you know, the kind of mapping that we do to convey these ideas of fiscal sustainability is not that dissimilar from what they've done here to look at patterns in zoning. And we talk about some other subject matters that could also benefit from that same type of widespread analysis. And so the data sharing that has really taken off in the last couple of decades is even more important now than ever, and puts us in the driver's seat of being able to make decisions with those things in mind and not playing a guessing game, which I think sometimes dissuades elected officials from making hard choices, is because they don't feel that they have enough information.
Yeah, I love the data in particular, that more data is becoming available. Not just that data is becoming available, but you're starting to see some consistency with how it's presenting different concepts or being used to analyze and present different concepts. And as we see so much with the work that we do of trying to, when you're trying to nudge a community towards something different, whether it's eliminating parking minimums or upzoning by right, whatever it might be, there's always that first response of like, well, where else is doing it, right? Who else is doing it? Who's done it? How has it worked? And just the more you saw it with parking minimums, especially the first few places that did it, we're real leaders. But now once there's just a couple out there that have shown, hey, it's actually working, you started to see this momentum grow and build. And I just think the initial effort to do just the Connecticut mapping that they did of, I can't imagine how intensive that was to do that, but they figured out kind of the process and the way to organize it and structure the data that now these other, well, I think it was other 9 or 10 states that are now doing it, the framework's there. So it's easier for them to do it. And then there's even more data that we can all reference and share and point to. So it's just a brilliant idea to just attack something that's at the center of everything that we're talking about with community building. I did find it interesting kind of in the middle of the interview where you were talking more about more of our work about maximizing existing infrastructure. She didn't really respond to that as much as I, maybe would have liked, but she kind of got at it with an earlier answer about when she was talking about how mapping could also be applied to transportation investments, or things like that. As I listened to the interview, I also thought a little bit about the conversations that we've had with SMU about some of the programs that SMU is doing about mapping infrastructure deserts. As a consultant, it's exciting that we're starting to get more of this kind of data, that these groups are starting to put time into researching things that are really important and organizing it in a way that's not just useful to like the technical nerds that want to geek out on data and GIS all day, but how to take that and present it in a way that's easily digestible by elected officials and by advocates so that they can kind of jump on board. So there's great stuff out there with land use fiscal analysis and with, parking reform, with Vision Zero and some of the transportation road redesign stuff that maybe is not as far as we would like it to see or like to see it. But nobody's really taking on zoning the way that Sarah and her team are doing it, which is very exciting. So I was glad we were able to get connected with her and talk with her. And it's going to be interesting to see where it goes as they add these other states. And who knows, maybe we can get Texas added to that list at some point. So, well, that's it for today. It was kind of a deep, expansive topic, but I think AJ, you and Sarah did a good job of keeping it simple and productive. And I'll just wrap with the way that you ended it with Sarah, which is, I think, our goal as well, which is trying to connect the values that we all share and have with the mechanisms that cities are using, because there's a very clear disconnect right now. And so that was a very succinct way of putting a lot of, not just zoning, but a lot of the stuff that we do is just trying to get our mechanisms and the decisions we're making to align better with the values that so many people have and the needs that so many people have. So Hope everybody enjoyed this conversation. I know there's a lot of resources that are dropped in the show notes. If you've got any questions for us, you can email them to us at podcast@verdunity.com or aj@verdunity.com or kevin@verdunity.com. We always love to hear the feedback. We've gotten some additional requests in for some other guests to line up, and I've also got a few lined up to feature some of the project work we're doing. So we're going to finish the year pretty strong with a few more interviews. But again, always like that feedback and like to hear what folks have to say. So thanks for listening to another episode, and we will see you next time on Go Cultivate.